Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Cote in Washington, D.C.
Unfortunately, we have seen a fact pattern over recent months that suggests that a free and fair election is in doubt.
A U.S. official expresses doubt about transparency of the coming elections in Zimbabwe.
Because this comes at the backdrop of, you know, increasing human rights violations by the state agencies, especially the soldiers who torture people, who violate the rights of citizens as they participate in their elections.
The United Nations Human Rights Commission closes its doors in Uganda.
These videos are aimed at pressurizing Parliament to suspend all the relevant standing orders and deliberate and pass what we are calling an emergency measures bill.
And a Malawian group plans to hold a series of vigils at the Parliament building beginning this week. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Despite repeated statements by Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa that he wants free and fair elections, a top U.S. diplomat in Washington says what is happening on the ground suggests that such polls in the Southern African nation is in doubt. In an exclusive interview with VOA Zimbabwe Services' Blessing Zulu, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Molly Fee says opposition political parties and citizens are being harassed and prevented from exercising their political freedoms. Fee says the U.S. has conveyed its concerns in its discussions with the Mnangagwa administration and that her country will be sending observers to the general election scheduled for August 23.
I would like to recall that the president of Zimbabwe, President Mnangagwa, has said repeatedly that he wants his country to hold free and fair elections. And we believe that would be the best path to promote peace and prosperity in Zimbabwe. Unfortunately, we have seen a fact pattern over recent months that suggests that a free and fair election is in doubt. And I can give you some examples of why we are concerned about that possibility.
If you may highlight your concerns.
Well, as you know, last month, new legislation called the Patriotic Act was adopted. And in fact, that legislation imposes restrictions on basic political freedoms agreed in Zimbabwe's constitution, in African Union protocols, and in UN protocols. And those include freedom of assembly that allows citizens and political parties to meet and prepare to engage in an election process. And it also includes restrictions on speech and expression, both by citizens, political parties, and journalists. So those are the types of actions that concern us. We've also seen opposition political parties and citizens actively harassed and prevented from exercising their political freedoms that should be guaranteed by those regimes that I've described, the regimes under the Zimbabwean constitution and as expressed by the African Union and the United Nations. So that's why we're concerned that the election won't achieve the standard highlighted by the president.
Talking to officials in Harare, they are saying that the U.S. actually has a similar law that penalizes those who commit acts that can be deemed to be treasonous to the state.
I don't think that's a fair comparison. We do have legislation that shares the same name, but the content of the law is very different. And I think they may be referring to a different law. In the United States, we take very seriously the freedoms of assembly, the freedoms of expression. We have had our own challenges, as you have seen in recent years, in terms of conducting our elections. But we have institutions, for example, primarily our judiciary, as well as congressional investigative action to check on our own election activities. Because as President Biden has said, he believes that democracy is the best form of government to unlock the potential of every human being to treat all equal before the law and to pave the way for stability that allows economic development.
But is there any communication about these concerns between Harare and Washington?
Yes, we have conveyed those concerns in our discussions with the government. We've also talked about them publicly. I would say we have welcomed the invitation of the government for observers to the election. We will be having an observer team from our embassy in Harare. And as well, it's my understanding that there'll be several international observers, for example, the Carter Center from the United States, as well as from the European Union and the African Union. And so we hope that those observers are able to conduct their traditional duties to ensure that on the day of the election, that voters are able to reach the polls freely, they're not harassed, and that the electoral process is conducted in a way that reflects the actual vote.
Why is it important for Harare to have free and fair elections that are accepted by Zimbabweans and the international community?
Well, again, first, a free and fair election is what is expressed in the Constitution of Zimbabwe and what has been called for by the president. In our experience in the United States, in our assessment of global experience, the best path for peace and prosperity is through a democratic system that respects all communities in a country, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of religion, regardless of any other category, that everyone is treated equal and allowed to participate freely in defining the future of their country. When you have political stability that results from a system such as I've described, then you have an opportunity to have good economic growth. We know and appreciate and respect Zimbabwe's complicated political history in the 20th century, but we also know that Zimbabwe has a rich history of success, enormous human talent, enormous natural resources. Zimbabwe has the potential to be a great leader in Southern Africa, and indeed to be a great participant in global conversation. So that's what we would like to see for the people and country of Zimbabwe.
Let's turn to political violence in opposition. Citizens Coalition for Change supporter was killed in Harare, allegedly, by ruling ZANU-PF supporters. What is your take on the issue of political violence?
Well, obviously, I oppose political violence both in my own country and in Zimbabwe and in any other country. You cannot have a functioning, healthy democracy if people are intimidated by violence. I know we've seen examples earlier this year of political parties and citizens exercising their democratic rights, being detained, being beaten up by police forces. The example you've just described of vigilante forces by the political party, all of that is disturbing and should be unacceptable for a government and a society committed to a true, free and fair election.
But the ruling party is saying that Mr. Mnangagwa has been calling for peace and nonviolence. Is it not enough?
Well, I think the example you just cited and the examples I have cited suggest that his rhetoric is not yet being translated into action. And we would urge the government to follow the rhetoric outlined by the president.
Molly Fee is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She spoke to VOA Zimbabwe Service's Blessing Zulu in Washington. Indonesia's coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment says the administration in Jakarta seeks to deepen relations with Africa. This after Minister Luhut Binsar Panjaitan led a delegation that held meetings on trade and multilateral relations with South Africa, Kenya, and Mozambique. Following a meeting with South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, Luhut says Indonesia plans to build a power plant in South Africa to help resolve an energy crisis that has forced it to ration electricity. I reached Indonesia's coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment, Luhut Binsar Panjaitan, via Skype. Here is a conclusion of the conversation.
So, Minister Luhut, do you think or does the administration in Indonesia think that Africa is an investment destination for the government and people of Indonesia?
Well, I think have to be the interest of both countries, you know, because Indonesia is very rich, and with the 282 million population, we are very rich in resources. If you are able to manage our own critical mineral and also our own potential renewable energy, 437 gigawatt, and also depleted reservoirs, saline aquifer, and seaweed, plantation like palm oil, you name it. We have everything. So we are not going to Africa to look something for our own interest. No, we just share what we experience with Indonesia and what we can do also together in Africa for the benefit of people of Africa and the people of Indonesia. So that's, I think, Peter, nothing to do that this is, you know, want to get something from Africa for the interest of Indonesia. No, we have enough. We have enough territory, we have enough problem, we have enough everything. So we can focus domestically. But if we could share something with our brother in brother and sister in Africa, why not?
Mr. Luhu, before you go, I know you're busy, but my last question to you is, what do you think are the prospects of this move to deepen trade relations, bilateral and multilateral relations between Indonesia and countries on the continent of Africa?
Well, I think beautiful, you know. At least we look at also we're going to sign some agreement with Kenya. We also import like 20,000 cattle from Kenya, and also we export palm oil, finished product for a while, but after a while we can do the processing in Mombasa, Kenya. And beside that, the President Ruto asked us whether we are able to build the oil refinery over there. And our state company, Pertamina, already engaged with Kenya. We're going to have oil refinery in Kenya. It is like maybe 300,000 barrel a day, gradually, of course. And we can supply to Kenya and also some other countries in eastern part of Africa. So that's, I think, the thing that we can do. This is some other thing, a lot, that go maybe in the mining area we can do together. But we tell them, we told them, like, look, don't export anymore your raw material if you can process first. I mean, the first time or the first stage of the downstreaming. Yeah. Hope that our friend in Africa can move even better than what happened today. And also about education, we can share also our experience in that Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Luhut Binsar Panjaitan is Indonesia's coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment. He spoke with me from Washington via Skype.
From the vast savannas to the lush rainforests of the continent, experience the soothing touch of shea butter and the nourishment of African black soap. On this week's episode of Our Voices, we'll be showcasing how these age-old skincare treasures have stood the test of time. Join the conversations Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
In Uganda, leading human rights defenders, activists, and civil society groups are expressing concern that they may face difficult challenges in the coming months and years. This after the UN Human Rights Commission officially ended its operations in Uganda on Saturday. The UN body closed its doors after the government declined to renew its mandate. Human rights and civil society groups say the move will make things difficult for them to operate, adding that freedom of expression and association will suffer. But the Ugandan Foreign Ministry says it is committed to the respect and promotion of human rights. For more reaction to the UN Human Rights Commission's closure in Uganda, I reach attorney Sarah Biriti. She is the founder and executive director for Center for Constitutional Governance, a Ugandan constitutional watchdog.
It's very unfortunate that last year the government of Uganda could not renew the mandate of the UN Human Rights Commission offices in Uganda. Because this comes at the backdrop of, increasing human rights violations by the state agencies, especially the soldiers who torture people, who violate the rights of citizens as they participate in their elections. And this torture and abuse has increased into kidnaps, you know, trials of civilians in military courts. And it's very unfortunate. The second unfortunate bit is that the government of Uganda cannot fund or empower the Uganda Human Rights Commission to fill the gap left by the UN Human Rights Office in Uganda.
Why do you say so? Because some people argue that the Uganda Human Rights Commission has been effective so far.
The Uganda Human Rights Commission has the mandate in the legal books. But when it comes to proper functioning, they are not empowered in terms of resources, but also in terms of political will and commitment. They are threatened. Recently, the chair of the Uganda Human Rights Commission made a statement that she's scared because some of her commissioners are armed and she doesn't know how to behave and she doesn't understand why they are armed, so people around her are armed. So there is intimidation, there is fear, there is also failure to give the necessary resources for the Uganda Human Rights Commission to do its work because there is no political commitment to the protection and observance of the rights of Ugandans by the political leadership.
Explaining the decision to end the mandate of the UN Human Rights Office earlier this year, the Ugandan Foreign Ministry assured the UN of its commitment to the protection and promotion of human rights in the country. Your reaction to this statement?
The evidence shows that the government of Uganda is not committed to protection of human rights can be found in the failure to punish the police officers or men in police uniform that caused the massacre on Kampala Street on November 18th and 19th of 2020, before elections. 54 people were murdered, according to the official government report, although non-state actors put these numbers above 100 deaths. But what is outstanding is the fact that none of the officers that killed the people has ever been punished.
Following this decision to end the mandate, what are your expectations and how does that make your work now that the UN Human Rights Commission basically has closed its doors?
What is clear to the international actors is the fact that this decision was made in bad faith on the part of government of Uganda, and it puts at risk the lives of human rights defenders, the lives of citizens, especially those that do not support President Museveni, because usually gross human rights violations are vested on the opposition supporters in Uganda. The President Museveni's regime does not respect dissent, the views of the people and free expression.
Attorney Sarah Birete is the founder and executive director for Center for Constitutional Governance. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Malawi, the Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives, or CDEDI, plans to hold a series of vigils at the parliament building in the capital, Lilongwe, this week. Sylvester Namiwa, executive director for CDEDI, says the move is meant to pressure the lawmakers to deliberate and pass an emergency maize measure. It will enable the government to immediately release food reserves across the country. This, he says, will help to sharply reduce the price of maize. Civil society groups have been expressing concern about the skyrocketing price of maize, a staple. They are calling on the government to increase its efforts to resolve the problem, warning that hunger will increase if the status quo remains. Sylvester Namiwa tells me that the government and the parliamentarians must act fast to avert looming hunger.
We have indeed notified the Lilongwe District Commissioner as per the law of our intention to hold vigils. These vigils are aimed at pressurizing Parliament to suspend all the relevant standing orders and deliberate and pass what we are calling an emergency measures bill that will see government engaging estates and commercial farmers to grow large-scale maize through irrigation to replenish our depleted strategic grain reserves.
But why do you think this is necessary, and why do you think Parliament has to stop all its work to take up this demand that you are making?
In Malawi, maize means life, and that we entirely depend on maize as a staple food. Now, as I'm talking to you now, details have emerged that the strategic grain reserves, despite being allocated 12 billion Malawi kwacha, they have meant that if it were to be released today nationwide, then it will only take us up to 2 months. That is disaster in the making, and the typical of disasters, this will hit hard the marginalized and the vulnerable people, and we'll see the needless loss of lives. Now, to avert that situation where we're going to lose a lot of people, we are challenging government through parliament to do the needful.
But the government, the government has made effort, and successive government have made effort to ensure that maize is readily available since it's a staple in Malawi. And the government of President Chakwera, I'm aware, has made efforts to try to encourage farmers to grow in large scale to meet demands. Why do you think this isn't enough?
On top of that one, the same government had to change the financial year to accommodate timely buying of maize. But as I'm talking to you now, our strategic grain reserves at Kanengo are empty. It is for this reason that you have, might have seen a communication to the effect that they wanted to bend laws in order to ease importation of maize. Now, in a country that is blessed with fertile soils, plenty of ground and underground water, by the way, in Malawi, everywhere where you dig 5 meters down, you're going to get fresh water suitable for irrigation. Instead of pressing a pressing button, we should do the needful. This is why we are advising this government to come up with a maize bill that will see the government engaging estates and commercial farmers to produce maize to replenish our stocks. And who knows, we're going to have a surplus which are going to sell and avert or contain other perennial challenge of foreign exchange. It's a no-brainer that we should be panicking when ours is counted to be an agrarian economy. Our soils are fertile. We have dedicated and hardworking people. Now, you see, our neighbors responded to our SOS by closing their own borders. Now, that means Malawi can no longer import maize from Tanzania, Zambia, and Mozambique.
Namiwa, like you said, the government has tried to ease restrictions that will enable the importation of maize. Isn't this the right move to make to meet demand?
We cannot play politics with the people's lives. Playing politics with maize is politicking with people's lives. And as I'm talking to you now, the neighboring countries have responded to our SOS by closing their borders. That means we cannot import maize from these countries. Secondly, we are facing a serious shortage of foreign exchange. We cannot import using Malawi kwacha. As of now, there are long queues in our fuel pumping stations because of the same problem of foreign exchange. Hospitals have run out of essential drugs and medicine. Now, we cannot add on our list of problems the importation of maize when actually we are blessed with fertile soils, we are blessed with ground and underground water. The sure way of doing it is to go through full throttle irrigation, and that irrigation has to be done to in large scale.
Sylvester Namiwa is the executive director at the Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives, or CDEDI. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says that the Sustainable Development Goals target for 2016 to 2030 are not likely to be met. The SDGs are a list of 17 objectives that serve as a shared blueprint for peace and prosperity for people around the world. The Secretary General is expected to present a yearly progress report about the SDGs, which were adopted in 2015. Jean Lomborg is the president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank. He authored a book titled Best Things First, the 12 most efficient solutions for the world's poorest and our global SDG promises. The book has been listed among the Financial Times' best summer books of 2023. It details how the world can do amazing things with little money. I read Jean Blomberg about what the challenges of the SDGs are and what can be done to make the world a better place.
So fundamentally, we promised way too much. We literally promised everything to everyone. And not surprisingly, we can't actually deliver on all of those promises. So we promised that we were going to fix hunger and malnutrition and poverty and disease, education, climate change, corruption, war, and everything else in between, along with, you know, organic apples and community gardens, all of which is nice. But of course, if you promise everything, you have no priorities. And so what I'm trying to say is we're now at halftime for the SDGs, and we're nowhere near halfway. If we're going to do better in the next part of the process, we really have to start thinking about what should we do first.
You wrote a book about how to resolve a lot of world problems, but how can we make sure we do better for the second half of this period? And if we cannot reach all 169 targets, in your estimation, how should we prioritize? What is the way forward here?
So at the end of the day, this is a political conversation. So politicians have to be honest and say, we can't do everything, and then let's do some things first. But you're asking me, and that's also what I wrote in the book, we work with more than 100 of the world's best economists, several Nobel laureates, to try to find out where can you get the most value for money. So basically, where can you spend an extra cedi or shilling or rupee or, you know, dollar or whatever your currency is, and do the most good for that money? That's the real question that we're trying to answer, because what that means is no matter how much money you have, you will make sure you get value for money, that you actually achieve as much as you can for the SDGs. And so what we have identified are 12 amazing things that can deliver a lot, but by no means all, but a lot of the SDGs, a lot of our promises.
Talking about investments, what are the best investments to make the world a better place based on the data that you have?
So we identified 12 great things. So let me just give you a few examples. So a lot of both mothers and newborns die around birth, and we know how to deal with a lot of this. It's mostly about getting more women to give birth in facilities, but also to make sure that those facilities are actually well-staffed and that they have basic emergency obstetric care. So this will cost in the order of $5 billion a year, but we estimate this will actually mean that you can save 166,000 moms each year, and you can save 1.2 million children each and every year. Just to give you one example, one of the things that hospitals and institutions should have is a little resuscitator, basically a air pump. So when the child is born, about 5% of all children don't breathe when they first get born, and they need to get a resuscitator, basically get a little bit of air into their lungs, and then they get going. That's just one of the great things we should do. We should also look at tuberculosis. We should also look at education, for instance. As you well know, education is a huge challenge everywhere, but perhaps especially so in the poor half of the world. We know that there's about 1/3 of a billion children in primary school in the poor half of the world, and many of them are not learning very much. One way to achieve that is to make sure that they all get taught at their own level. Remember, if you have 50 kids in a class, they're all 12 years old, but they're widely different in their abilities. Some of these kids are far ahead. A lot of these kids have no clue what's going on. One teacher just can't teach all of them at their particular level.
Now, Mr. Lomberg, the SDGs, as you are aware, have a global focus, but each country reasonably has different preconditions and specific challenges. Now, can your approach be tailored, measured to regional or national level to make sure each country gets the best possible results to resolve their specific challenges?
That's a great question. So yes, absolutely. So we've done a global analysis where you can spend money globally and achieve the most for the SDGs. But as you rightly point out, every country is unique and every country has its own conversations about what should be their priorities. And so we actually work with a number of different governments in Africa and elsewhere to talk about What should your particular country do? So we work with Ghana, we work with Uganda, we're working with Namibia and Eswatini, and we're in the process of talking to several more, where we take a look at what are the plans for spending in the next couple of years. And then we try to say, with economics, what do we know works very well and what do we know works less well? So essentially, if you imagine, if you have politicians' wish list of 50 things they would like to do, we score them and show these things are dark green, these are incredibly good, these things are pretty good, they get a yellow, and some things are actually dumb, they get a red. And so we hope to help make both bureaucracies and politicians prioritize more of the really good ones.
Jean Lomberg is the president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank. He spoke with me from the Swedish capital, Stockholm.
Global temperatures heading towards alarming highs and extreme weather. How is the weather in your country? Call us on WhatsApp and let us know how you're coping with the change of weather norms. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Nigeria's female basketball team, the Tigres, have defeated Senegal to win the 2023 FIBA Women's Afro Basket Championship for the fourth consecutive time. Nigeria became the first team to win four FIBA Women's Afro Basket titles in a row over the last four decades, thanks to an 84-74 win over Senegal on Saturday in Kigali, Rwanda. Prior to Nigeria, Senegal was the last team to win four African titles in the 1970s. The Tigres' sixth continental title came exactly 20 years after they conquered their very first African crown in 2003 in Maputo, Mozambique. The victory means the Tigres will now compete for a spot at the women's basketball event of the 2024 Olympics. For their part, the Lionesses have now lost to the Tigres in four AfroBasket finals, 2005, 2017, 2019, and 2023. For newly appointed the Tigres head coach, Rena Wakama, she becomes the first woman to lead a team to the AfroBasket title.
It's really not about me, okay? They came together and got this thing done, okay? I was just, you know, the leader telling them what to do, but they were out there performing and leaving it all out there for me. I think it was Mozambique when we went down, I think 10 or 12, okay? The look in my girls' eyes, like, they told me they weren't gonna lose. So I knew what type of team I had when we were down Mozambique and we came back to win. So that was a defining moment for me.
From the Afro Basket to the Women's World Cup, co-hosted by New Zealand and Australia, a courageous performance by South Africa's national women's team, Banyana Banyana, was not enough to overcome the Netherlands as the European side won 2-0 to advance to the World Cup quarterfinals on Sunday. The Dutch team showcased their prowess on the field with goals from Jill Rod and Lynette Bezentin, overcoming a spirited Banyana Banyana side. Despite being the underdogs, South Africa took the game to the Dutch in an entertaining last 16 clash at the Sydney Stadium in Sydney, Australia on Sunday. And now to athletics, where the 9th Francophone Games, which began on July 28th, will come to a close on Sunday, August the 6th. Over 3,000 athletes from 37 countries are participating in the games being hosted in Kinshasa, Congo DR's capital. Ziana Mina, head of the International Committee of the 9th Francophone Games, said despite all the difficulties, concerns and uncertainties surrounding the games, it turned out to be very successful.
In boxing news, a heavyweight boxing rematch between British Nigerian boxer Anthony Joshua and Dillian White has been cancelled after White returned an adverse finding to a random doping test. The rematch was scheduled to hold on Saturday, August 12th at London's O2 Arena. Joshua's promoters, Matchroom, are looking for a replacement opponent to meet him at the same location on the same day. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. On this momentous day, large numbers of concerned Africans are monitoring with anxiety developments that may or may not occur at the brief timeline given by ECOWAS to the coup makers in Niger. The request is that within that period, they should reinstall the legally elected president and then may go back to their barracks. As we know, the head of the military group removed the president has been very defiant. He had made it clear that they would not comply with the request of ECOWAS. Apart from that, we have also heard from at least 4 or 5 ECOWAS members who have denounced any use of force by ECOWAS against Niger. Also, outside of the sub-region, other Africans, members of the African Union, have also strongly objected to the use of force in Niger. During the course of this week, the brief timeline, we have also seen serious developments. Many who have attempted to help in resolving the issue peacefully, the last of which is a mission, and the head of the junta even did not meet with the team. Also during this brief period, all European civilians residing in Niger have been removed from arm's way and flown out of the country. So in a sense, only the Nigerian civilians are now exposed in arm's way should there be clash of arms. We are also aware that right now, residents in Niger are over 2,500 troops from France and the United States. Last Friday, the junta requested the immediate removal of French troops from Niger, and the government of France rejected that, saying that only the duly elected president could give such an order. Africans were also alarmed in a way by the hint by ECOWAS a no-flow zone is being installed in Niger. Their concern rose out of the memory that it was the use and misuse of a Security Council no-fly zone over Libya with the admonition that there should be no boots on the ground that resulted in chaos in Libya, which still continues, and also the ultimate death of the head of state, Gaddafi, after which the floodgates were opened, and we have seen the flow of arms and ammunition with the rebels to the south. And that happened that the first victim was Mali, when the ancient city of Timbuktu was sacked and many valuable literature were destroyed. So any reference to no-fly zone is a red flag to many Africans. Who is there to tell what would happen in a situation where you have such confrontations? At least 2 members of ECOWAS, Mali and Burkina Faso, have said any use of force by ECOWAS will be seen as a declaration of war on them, and that therefore they would be obliged to intervene in Niger in its defense. So we are dealing with a very serious situation. But we should also remember that when ECOWAS first went into the business of peacekeeping, it was never conceived as an enforcement military force. ECOMOG was created within the compass of the Chapter 8 of the Charter of the United Nations dealing with regional arrangements. For all Africans, as you watch this day, hoping perhaps that people will stop at the brink. Because when ECOWAS has used peacekeeping as in Liberia to begin with, it did not go there to initiate violence. It went to remove violence, the slaughtering of ethnic groups in the streets and even in the churches. Similarly, in Sierra Leone, ECOWAS did not go there to start violence. It went to stop violence. So it will be sad indeed if, in the case of Niger, that armed use by ECOWAS could really result in bloodbath. So still appeals should be made that people should be very, very, very careful. Three things now stand out. The first is this. Any selective outrage at coups in Africa is not a recipe for enhancing confidence in institutions, states, or group of states. Secondly, should there be bloodbath in Niger, Africans will be obliged to ask whose nutshells are being removed from the fire by ECOWAS. Second view is that one should be mindful that those who start a war never know how it will end. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
She's a good belly dancer. The way how you wine, girl, you look so romantic. Like the way how you bake it. The way how you wine, girl, you got me confessing. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Power. Your body, they don't go, they jealous you. Who love na sababu. Now na trouble every day. You go see you young today. No the kiss, no the hug again, no. Love today, not to love today. Love not to yak back. Love not to force. If the man don't like you like him, mama. Left and go. Love not to yak back. Love not to force. If the man don't like you like him, mama.
Yeah. night. Enter bathroom, fresh up.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if the tree does not know how to dance, the wind will teach it. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
The way you're smiling, y'all about the pretty life.